This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with Colonel Ralph Thompson of the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force. Today is the 13th of February, 2006. I am in Lubbock on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Building, and the Colonel is speaking to me by telephone from North Carolina. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And, sir, I'm very grateful to you for spending some time with the Oral History Project. It's an honor to include you.
Okay.
First of all, sir, would you mind giving some basic biographical data? Where were you born, sir, and when?
In Louisiana, 24 August 1916.
And I see that you still have your Louisiana accent with you.
I guess.
I'm glad to hear that. Tell me a little bit about your family, if you would, sir.
Well, my wife and I have been married 52 years. You talk about my immediate family here or my...
Well, your family growing up.
Growing up.
Tell me about
up.
Your parents.
Yeah, well, my parents were... My father was a cattle, horse and cattle trader.
Uh-huh.
And he ran a store also. And that was it. My mother died when I was 12 years old. And I left home a little later.
Now, you had a number of brothers and sisters.
I had one sister.
Okay, one sister. And where did you fit in the group? Were you oldest, youngest?
I was the oldest, yes.
Okay. And where is Amite, Louisiana?
Where is it, Louisiana?
Mm-hmm.
About 69 miles north of New Orleans. There's New Orleans, and then you go up Ponchatoula across the lake, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Hammond, and then a couple other little towns, and then I met.
I see. Now, it's just a tiny little town, or it was then?
Yeah, it's still not very big.
Mm-hmm. Sir, let me ask about your schooling. Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to school, and I met grammar school and high school. I did not graduate.
What year did you leave then, after the age of 12?
Yeah, I left there when I was about 13 or 14, uh-huh. About 14, I think.
And where did you go?
Well, I got a job on a ship.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I walked into the shipping office in New Orleans and asked for a job and got it. That was it. The only thing is,
mm-hmm.
It was on a coal-burning ship. And when I got into the Suez Canal, I already had my bags packed, and we got close to the side. I just stepped over.
You did?
Yep.
About what year was this?
Pardon?
What year do you think this was?
Oh, that would have been, I'm trying to think, 29... It would have been about 1932 or 3.
And what happened when you got off the ship?
Well, I had to disappear for a little bit, and then I went to the consulate and told them I had missed my ship.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was funny. I missed it with packed bags.
A little suspicious. Mm-hmm. And first of all, why had this been your plan all along once you knew you were going to go that far over to the Suez Canal?
No, I didn't know where I was going.
Okay, so did you just want off the ship?
Pardon? I wanted off that ship.
Uh-huh.
It was a coal burner, nasty, dirty.
Okay. It was pretty miserable.
Yeah, it was bad.
What were you supposed to be doing on the ship? What was your job?
I was what they called a wiper. You wipe up the oil and grease and stuff in the engine room.
Okay, so pretty hard, miserable work, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. I might have gotten off the ship, too. So you went into the U.S. consulate. Uh-huh. What happened then?
Well, like I said, they laughed when I said I'd missed my ship.
Uh-huh.
With packed bags. I said, yeah. So anyway, they got me transportation back to the States on another ship.
Did you have to pay for it, or how did work out?
No, I worked my way back.
I see. What kind of ship was this?
Well, it was an oil burner, much cleaner.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a similar type job?
Yeah, it was a wiper, what they call a wiper.
Mm-hmm. And did you stay with that kind of work for a while?
Well, I would have stayed with it permanently, probably, but I got caught in a strike on the West Coast in 1934. I believe it's 34.
Now, when you say you got caught in a strike, does that mean that the strike shut down the ships?
Well, when the ship pulled into dock, everybody walked off except the ship's officers and another stupid kid and me.
And why did you two not go?
Well, because nobody told us there was a strike, and we were not members of the Seamen's Union, so we didn't know very much about the whole thing, you know?
Uh-huh.
The only thing is the people on the ground, the strikers, kept sending word that we better get off, that they'd kill us if we didn't.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So the captain finally said, you boys better leave. You can always get a job back after the strike is over.
Uh-huh.
But when we went ashore, they dumped our stuff all out on the street and beat us up pretty well. So that was it.
They were thinking that you were basically breaking the strike by staying on the ship?
Well, I don't know what they thought, but, you know, they were a pretty rough crowd. So.
Yes, sir.
I don't know what they thought.
And you, did you get hurt seriously?
Well, yeah, I was in the hospital for about 10 days.
Oh, boy. What about the other young man? Do you know?
He got away. He managed to get up and run. And I made a mistake of trying to gather up my clothes, which they had scattered out on the street.
Yes. Now, what happened to you when you were released from the hospital?
Well, while I was in the hospital, this sergeant, which I didn't know was a sergeant at the time, kept passing by my door because he was visiting his father-in-law in the room up the way. And so one day he stopped in, and I told him I was looking for, I'd be looking for a job that didn't have anything to do with unions.
So
I expect the Army doesn't have unions. And he said, no, that's right, but they had a 3-year waiting period. So anyway, in the general discussion, it came out that I could ride a horse pretty well, so he wanted to know if I'd show him. So I said, as soon as I get out of here, I'd be glad to.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and demonstrated that I could ride a horse, and so he enlisted me.
He did?
No, he didn't. The colonel that ran the base there at the Presidio did, so they enlisted me there.
Now, they took you on right away on the basis that they thought you, might go into the cavalry or something?
Yes.
Okay. And did this suit you okay? Did this sound like a pretty good option?
Sounded like a good deal to me. There were no unions involved.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, tell me about your initial experiences. Were you sworn in?
Oh, yeah.
Where did that happen? At the Presidio?
At the Presidio.
Uh-huh. And did you go for a period of training somewhere?
No. They didn't, that didn't come about until later. I mean, in those days, every outfit trained its own people as it received them.
And this would be about 1937, I think, according to the notes that you sent in?
Yes.
Okay. So did you stay there at the Presidio or in the Bay Area?
Only for a short while.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, where did I go from there? I'm trying to remember. Yeah. I forgot where I went now. I think to Barksdale, Louisiana.
And what happened there? What sort of jobs or training were you given?
Well, when I first got there, I was assigned to ward duty, you know, a ward man on one of the hospital wards. And then I went down to the School of Aviation Medicine to learn to be a flight surgeon's assistant.
Now, at this point, you had been thinking that you were going to be in the cavalry.
Oh, yeah.
And were you amenable to kind of this change of direction?
Oh, yeah.
For the medical field?
Well, I was assigned to the cavalry, but they detailed me into the medical field.
I see.
And finally it became permanent, so I didn't mind.
Okay.
I liked it.
How did things go with your first few days on the hospital ward? Do you remember, did anybody take you under wing and help you learn?
Oh, yeah. Several of the guys there did. They were friendly, and everything worked out fine. I kind of just naturally fell into it.
Now, Ralph, at some point, were you also given weapons training so that you would, you know, have facility with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, during those days, every unit trained its own people.
Yes.
I had been there maybe 2 weeks when we had weapons training. And we went out on the range and learned, you know, to handle a pistol and a rifle.
Mm-hmm. Had you had any experience with firearms before?
Oh yeah. As a kid, I always had a .22 rifle from the time I can remember.
Yes, sir. So this was kind of not a big challenge for you.
No, it wasn't a big challenge at all. That was a good shot.
Now, what else were they training you in terms of the medical field?
Well, like I said, I worked along on the ward there, and I worked in the emergency room, and then they sent me to the School of Aviation Medicine to learn to be an assistant to the flight surgeon.
Now, where was that school held?
In San Antonio, Texas, at Randolph Air Force Base.
Okay. And if you would, sir, I think it might be interesting for people to know something about the curriculum that was assigned to you, such that you would be prepared to assist a flight surgeon.
Well, the flight surgeon, you know, was a physician.
Yes.
And we were his assistant, which meant that we did, for instance, one of the tests that was very important during those days was one that they taught us to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I've forgotten the name of it even. But we did that, and then we typed up the forms and all that sort of stuff.
So you had some administrative work training.
Some. I wasn't a very good typist, but I did it.
Yes, sir. What about things like blood draws and so on? Would you do that?
Pardon?
Would you do blood drawing and all that kind of stuff?
I learned to do that, yes.
Now, when you finished your training in San Antonio, where were you posted?
Barksdale Air Force Base.
Okay, so you went back to Barksdale.
Mm-hmm.
And with what unit, sir?
I was with the medical unit there.
Okay.
The hospital.
Okay. Do you remember, did it have a hospital designation? Did it have a unit number? Was it?
No, just a station hospital.
I see.
Barksdale Air Force Base, and I was attached to the 13th Attack Squadron for flight duty.
Okay. Now, can you tell me, for example, if you were there and in that posting when you heard about Pearl Harbor? Or where were
you? Let me think, where was I? So for some reason, I was being assigned to the West Coast. I've forgotten what the reason was.
Mm-hmm.
And so Pearl Harbor came along about the time I reported for duty on the West Coast.
And what base did you report to?
Well, I reported to Fort Ord, and they didn't have any idea why I was there, and neither did I. So I was sort of lost.
did you find somewhere to be besides Fort Ord, or did you make your place there?
Well, no, they kept me there. And,
they sent, okay.
Uh-huh. And what I did for the next couple of months was train troops. Since I had weapons training and was a good shot and stuff like that, so they put me in charge of teaching a lot of these people to handle a rifle.
So your duty right at the outset of the war was rifle training for Army.
Yeah, at Fort Hall.
Enlisted men.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's quite something. So in a very short period, you had quite a range of of experiences. Well, sir, what if you can remember? What was the mood What do you remember feeling about the war, either in the Pacific or the war that was already developing in Europe? What were your feelings about it, and what was the mood?
Well, I would have preferred to go to Europe, and I volunteered for Europe, but unfortunately I was on the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted people in the Pacific, so I was sent out in the Pacific.
Did you feel that, what was the sense, if you can recall, of patriotic feeling? Did you feel that the Japanese...
Well, I think I was, like most people, very angry because of their sneaky attack, you know?
Uh-huh. Sure, sure.
And,
you said that you had volunteered for Europe. Were you concerned about the situation over there, too?
A young guy like me, I knew there was a war going on over there, and I figured if there's something to see, I want to see it.
You want to get into it.
Yeah, so, but unfortunately, I was on the West Coast, so I went within the Pacific.
Now, how long did you spend at Fort Ord doing the training duty for other folks?
Oh, let's see, I think about 2 weeks, maybe.
Okay, and then what happened after that?
Well, then we moved up to Camp Stoneman, which is a little north of there, and my job was, as I was told by the sergeant in charge of things, was take this bunch of men out and take 20 pounds off each one of them. So we ran out across the sand dunes up there.
Uh-huh. So you were trying to get them into shape?
Yes.
Wow. You must have been in pretty good shape at that point.
I was in good shape. Yes. I was a young, slim, skinny kid.
Now, what was your rank?
Pardon?
What was your rank at this time?
At that time, let's see, I think I had just made sergeant.
Okay. And so you were put in charge of this group?
Yeah, I had a group that I had to take 20 pounds off each man.
And did you do it?
Pretty much so, yeah.
And you did it by making them run through the...
Yeah, run across those sand hills. And...
Boy, I bet they loved you.
Yeah, they did.
I'll bet.
They used to express it every now and then.
Oh, I'm sure.
So, you know, we had a little arguments every now and then.
Undoubtedly, and I think unavoidably.
Mm-hmm.
But did you have a sense that you liked being a little more in charge? And that you could be in command, you could do that?
Yeah, I liked it pretty much. I'd rather be telling people what to do than have them telling me what
yes,
to do.
Sir. Well, since you rose to the rank of colonel, I think you did get your chance to tell people what to do.
Yeah, I did.
Sir, how long did you stay up at Camp Stoneman?
As I remember, about 10 days or 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then they woke me up one morning, about 2 o'clock or something like that, said, get your men ready and go down to the railhead, and there's a train there. They'll show you where to board. So I took my people down there, and we boarded the train. We wound around through California, God knows where, until about 10 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
We pulled up beside the ship on the dock, you know, and right up the gangplank.
Is that right? Do you know the name of the ship?
Yeah, the MV Noordam, motor vessel Noordam. It was a Dutch ship.
Do you know how to spell that for us?
Noordam.
And it was a Dutch ship.
Dutch ship, and the captain was named Dolken.
Uh-huh. Now, what did they have quarters for your guys? Was it a troop transport, or what was it?
Yeah, it was had been a liner, and
uh-huh.
they had converted it to a troop transport.
Okay.
So they crowded 200 people into a cabin that normally held 2 or 3 people, you know.
Oh, boy. Yikes.
And all the bunks were 6 high, you know, 6 high.
Oh, sure. Did you stay with your unit, or did you have separate accommodations?
Oh, I was with my unit.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
we got overseas, and when I'm trying to remember, not too long after we got out on the out of the harbor there, out on the ocean. I think we were jumped by some submarines. I don't know that because I didn't see any, but they said that was it because we broke off from the convoy and took off on our own. And the ship I was on was fast, and the motor was real fast, so that we took off and kept going until we landed in New Zealand.
Where did you come in at New Zealand?
Auckland.
You must have been pretty glad to see Auckland.
I was.
Yes, sir. Not only is it beautiful, but it would have been a huge relief, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Was that crossing a tough one for you guys?
Well, the ship was crowded, you know.
Sure.
And I think at that point I was only a buck sergeant. No, I wasn't. By then I was a master sergeant.
Oh, really? Okay.
And, you know, it was just crowded. We had certain little chores to do, you know, every now and then. My unit, I was in charge of one of the bays where 75 to 100 people were bunked, you know, where two or three used to be, you know. Anyway, we had our little chores on the ship. We were on gunnery duty every now and then, and deck sweeping and stuff like that, you know.
Now, when you got to New Zealand, what did you find out was the plan? Were you going to stay there for a while, or what?
Well, actually, I was supposed to be the chief clerk in the theater surgeon's office. And we were in Auckland, but I didn't see anybody from that office for the first couple of weeks, so I just did routine duty around the camp there.
Now, the camp, was it set up outside of the city?
It's just outside of Auckland, yeah.
Actually,
it was in a park. I've forgotten the name of the park, but there was a park in Auckland that had been taken over, and all these little huts had been built. And they had 8 men to a hut, and all 8 couldn't stand up at the same time, so they had to stand up in shifts, you know.
Were you excited to think that you might be seeing some action?
Well, I don't know whether I was excited or not. I was looking forward to seeing some, but unfortunately at that point I was captured by one of the officers I had known before had been selected to be the theater surgeon. And he caught me, and I was assigned to his outfit.
Now, what did the theater surgeon's office, what was specific about its mission?
Well, it placed in the position all the medical units in the theater and supervised all of the hospitals that were set up and running and, you know, things like that.
Now, for the entire Pacific Theater?
No, just for the South Pacific Theater.
Okay.
The Western Pacific was the Southwestern Pacific was another theater.
Yes, sir. And was it the case that this meant you would stay in Auckland?
No. Let's see, we were in Auckland perhaps 2 or 3 months. And then we moved up to Noumea, New Caledonia.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me a little bit about Noumea. It's not a very big island, is it?
New Caledonia? No, it's not very big. And at that point, there was the northernmost part of the island is where the only airfield at that time was. And it was a place called Plain de Gaillac. And there was one road that came down the island and then down to Noumea.
Uh-huh.
And Noumea was they had nickel docks there where the metal nickel was, they got it somewhere, I don't know where.
Mm-hmm. They're mining it.
Yeah, and it was processed there and shipped out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, there was one road down there that became pretty crowded after, you know, after several thousand, 100,000 troops were pulled. boarding on the island there.
Mm-hmm.
And the only real city was Noumea, and it was kind of overrun, you know, because it's a French island.
Yes. Could you get any sense of the sort of French colonial presence there at all?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they were there. They were not exactly friendly towards us, but...
Is that right?
You know, they were out to everything they could for us, you know.
Now, Colonel, when you say they weren't too friendly, do you remember any incidents or...?
No, there was no real incidents. Uh-huh. It's just that there was only one city there, Noumea, and there was limited, you know, what you could get there.
Yes.
And what you got, you paid plenty for, and that was about it.
I'm sure that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was the climate like?
Well, it's usually warm. It never did get cold. It might have got down to maybe 60 degrees or something like that. Maybe 55.
Mm-hmm.
About the lowest it got.
Mm-hmm. Was it? Would you say if there hadn't been a war on, and if it had been just a sleepy kind of French colonial island, would it have been a pleasant place to visit?
No, I don't think so.
Not really.
There were a lot of mosquitoes there, and a lot of the guys got malaria pretty soon. I didn't, but a lot did. But we all got dengue fever. At that point, people thought you could only have dengue fever one time, but after the theater surgeon had it for the fifth time, he agreed, you know, you could have it more than once.
He came around to that conclusion.
He came around, yeah.
Colonel, can you tell me what dengue fever does to a person?
Well, it's one of those fevers where you run a pretty high fever for a short period of time, and then when you get over it, you feel pretty good.
So it's a short, sharp shock?
Short-term malady, and you get over it, and you feel all right. You know, it's kind of like being seasick.
Okay, you can get through it. Do you have any lasting effects?
Not that I know of. No.
Okay, but pretty much everybody's got this. At some
pretty
point.
Much everybody got okay. it. Yeah.
And now you said that a lot of the other fellows got malaria at this time. What were the drugs that they were giving? For that.
Well, Adderbrin had just come out,
uh-huh.
and so they were giving people Adderbrin,
uh-huh.
both as a preventive and as a cure, you know?
Yes, sir.
So everybody turned kind of yellow.
Yes, sir. and how do you think you avoided coming down with it?
Well, because I think because I was born and as a kid in Louisiana, my mother used to give us quinine at certain parts of the year, you know, tonics.
Sure.
And I think I had built up of some immunity to it. I don't know. Mm. I never got it.
Now, where were you housed? Were you actually in Noumea?
No, about maybe 2 miles to the south of Noumea.
Okay. And what did your accommodations look like there? Were they temporary, very temporary?
Tents.
That's what I thought.
Eight-man tents.
That's pretty hard going.
Oh, yeah.
What did you do, for example, for water supply? Do you remember?
They got some of the natives there
mm-hmm.
to construct a pipeline of bamboo from up springs up in the hills over the city down to the collection point down at our camp.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Did that ever did it hold up that system?
Oh yeah.
Okay. How long were you there?
Well, let's see, we were there I guess I was there for almost a year, I think.
Is that right? And your work was primarily what?
Well, I was sort of at that point the chief clerk in the theater surgeon's office.
Mm-hmm. And so what would a typical day look like for you there? Do you remember?
Yeah, I went to work usually pretty early in the morning, around 6 or something like that, and shuffling big shipments of medical supplies and units and things all over the place, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you...
It was mostly office work at that point.
Okay, yeah, a lot of paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
And you were keeping track of... For example, would you keep track of personnel as well as supplies?
Oh, yeah, personnel. You know, like we're trying to get the right teams, medical teams, into certain positions, you know, because we had to provide the tactical unit, you know, like the surgeons attached to the tactical units as well as to the hospitals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we were setting up hospitals all over the place and then trying to keep people into the, for instance, a battalion surgeon, you know, had one doctor usually, or two, you know, veterinarian and a dental surgeon, things like that, you know,
mm-hmm.
teams in each unit and hospitals at the same time, you know, we're trying to keep them all pretty well balanced.
And this was all in support of the Army's personnel in the Pacific.
Yes.
Can you tell me where primarily Army units were stationed, such that you had to support them in? Was it in New Guinea and the Philippines?
No, we had them. Well, of course, I was east of the Philippines, or, you know, back toward the States.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And from about halfway between us and the Philippines was the line which was the Southwest Pacific, which was MacArthur's territory.
Yes, sir.
Our boss, our big boss, was,
yeah.
was a little general by the name of, it was on the tip of my tongue, just slipped out. Anyway.
That's okay.
He didn't make it out of the war. He was lost at sea. Anyway, he was a full general. I can't think of his name at the moment.
That's okay. That's okay. And would your support extend all the way back to units in Australia and New Zealand, U.S. units there?
Not Australia. That was MacArthur's territory.
Okay.
And our territory mostly was from New Caledonia north up to, I can think of it, Roses and... I'm trying to think of the real names of the places. Right on up to Guadalcanal, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All the islands that we had units and people on.
And you had a lot. I mean, things were moving very quickly, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
In, let's say, I'm not sure exactly of the dates that you would have been on New Caledonia. Would it mm-hmm. be in 43 and 44, something like that?
Would have been 43, I believe.
43. Yeah, there was a great deal of movement in this whole island hopping campaign, as they call it.
Yeah, and somewhere along the way that I was commissioned, I got what they call an overseas or battlefield type commission. And so I was commissioned a second lieutenant.
And was that a proud moment? Was it a big deal to you to make that grade, or were you just busy about your business? And
well, yeah, it meant there wasn't as many people telling me what to do.
yes sir. Did you feel like you were part of the war?
Oh yeah.
I would have thought so. I mean, you're not, your position was not one of
I wasn't in a combat unit.
Right, you weren't meeting the Japanese, but you,
no.
But you were
backing up the people who were,
and and making sure that those
yeah.
guys that needed help got it.
Right.
How big an operation? I mean, this had to be an absolutely enormous effort.
Oh, it was.
I mean, I can't even imagine organizing this.
Well, of course, we had units on all the islands. Up to and including Guadalcanal, and so we had to keep people up there, you know, and some of them were getting killed, you know, some of our people were getting killed along with the rest of them. So we had to keep a constant replacement thing going, you know, and at the same time set up support hospitals in the safe areas, you know.
Yes, and it just seems like it must have been an enormous undertaking.
Yeah, it was.
And you saw a lot of paperwork then, I'm sure, go through.
Oh, my God, yeah.
What, if anything, Colonel, do you remember as being problematic? Were there shortages of certain things, or was it transportation that was a problem, where was the rub? I mean, in a big operation like this, what were the things that?
Well, you knew what you were supposed to get, but you had to settle with what you actually got, you know.
Yes, sir.
And sometimes there was quite a considerable bit of difference there.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in my own case, I didn't have an officer's uniform of any kind. I needed officer's work clothes and uniform type clothes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it got within 3 days of me and then was sunk.
Is that right?
Yeah, so a lot of things were that way, you know. Supplies went down with ships and things of that nature.
You know? Now, what were you making do with? Just fatigues, or what did you have?
What do you mean, personal stuff?
Yeah, to wear.
I had the same stuff I had as an enlisted man after I was commissioned because I couldn't get anything else.
Yes, sir. So you didn't have? Did you have bars? Did you have lieutenant's bars at all?
Oh yeah, I finally got. Somebody gave me lieutenant's bars. Yeah.
Somebody came through with the hat.
Yeah, and one of the big deals, as far as I was concerned, there was a Navy warehouse on the island there that carried marine type shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And these were they were these, you know, out of buck high top shoes.
Yes,
and
sir.
I have very narrow feet, so they had narrow, and so I was happy about that.
You got a pair of shoes that fit.
I did, yeah.
Wow. Well, I can't think of anything that for the guys would have been more important, because you know when you have a bad pair of shoes, it's just ruin your whole day, really.
Ruins everything. Yeah.
Yes, sir. How was the health of the guys that were there at Noumea generally? Did you have to have a hospital there to manage people who were sick?
We had. I'm trying to think. I think we had three hospitals on the island.
Okay.
And of course, a lot of the people that were in those hospitals were shipped down from combat areas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they came in from combat areas, as well as those that were generated. As I said, there's one road from Noumea up to Plaine de Gaillac, the northern piece of the island.
Mm-hmm.
And that road put a lot of truck drivers in graves, and some made it through the hospitals because it was a very dangerous road up through the mountains, you know.
Was it very narrow and just cut on the side?
It was narrow and winding and
mm-hmm.
just a poor road, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, and you know, after a year or so, they had it pretty well widened, and you know.
Sure, but it's
funny things would happen.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed funny now. They weren't funny at the time. But I was taking a convoy up that road one time and had to stop because a British unit, well, actually they were Australians,
mm-hmm.
had decided to have tea right in the middle of the road. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I got out and asked them to please move and let us by, and they said, after we have our tea, and I said, okay, sit there, damn it, and I'll run right over you. So they finally moved.
I had a little culture clash there.
Yeah, a little bit.
Did they move?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
They weren't very quick about it, but they moved.
Yes, sir, I can well imagine. I can well imagine. Now, would that kind of thing happen on a regular basis where you were detailed to or had to take care of a convoy or a group of trucks?
every now and then something like that would happen. Mm-hmm. You know, when we were trying to get people into a hospital, that, for instance, that was set up about 50 or 60 miles up the road, I'd have to take them up there, and God knows how long it would take because it all depended on what kind of convoy you got behind.
Yes, sir. Know. Yeah, with one road. And
yeah.
No,
it was sort of crowded.
Yes, sir. In the hospitals on the island, can you say or estimate how many, what percentage of the beds would be taken up by combat casualties and what percentage by, say, illnesses like malaria?
I would say about 50-50, mm-hmm. Because a lot of them would be malaria, you know. Mm-hmm. What they do is they'd give the troops in the heavy malaria zones, what's the stuff? Anyway, Ativan.
Uh-huh.
And then when they pull them out of that area, they'd take them off the Ativan. So these people would drop like flies, you know. They'd be walking along all of a sudden down because the malaria hit them, you know. So
wow.
There's a lot of malaria in the hospitals.
Were there nurses on the island?
Oh yes.
Uh huh. And were they a source of particular interest, or did you ever meet any of those gals?
Well, of course, we had the chief nurse of the theater was in the same office I was in.
Do you remember her?
Oh yeah, I'm trying to think of her name. As a matter of fact, after the war, she and the theater surgeon were married. I can't remember her name. Can't even remember it. But the theater surgeon was Earl Maxwell, and she became Mrs. Maxwell after the war.
I see. Uh-huh. Now, she would have been doing administrative work.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, and being sure that the right nurses were in the right places, you know.
Sure, yeah. And again, another huge element. The nurses, were their personnel issues handled completely separately from the doctors and dentists and others?
The personnel?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, each of us looked after a certain portion. For instance, the chief nurse looked after all the nurses to be sure the right nurse was in the right unit and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
I worried about the Medical Service Corps people and the vets and things like that.
You were also concerned with the vets?
Well, I did with the veterinarians and the dentists and the physicians, you know.
Wow. Well, do you remember your time at Noumea as a very good time, or was it?
Well, it was a hard working time, and sometimes very frustrating.
Yes, I'm sure that's true.
But other than that, it was a good assignment.
Now, where did you move after your year or so there expired?
Well, let's see. I went to Okinawa, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have a sense of when that would have been? I mean, obviously after we had taken Okinawa, after the United States had taken it, and of course that was a horrible battle.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find out much about the events?
Yeah, I saw a lot of the battle.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that, Colonel?
It was rough because they were using these kamikazes, Japanese pilots that had sworn to.
Yes.
To die for the country, I guess, because their role was to fly right into whatever they were aiming at, you know.
Yes, sir.
Ships or whatever, you know.
Yes, sir. Were you out on a ship, or
no,
were you on the ground?
No, I was on shore.
Uh-huh.
I was up on a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Was about 100 feet above the water, and so I could look all out through the, you know, across the area.
And was your task there similar to what you had been doing at Noumea, trying to get...
Same thing, yeah.
Uh-huh. Was it actually the theater office had been moved up there?
part of it.
Okay. And what? How did they make the distinction of what would move forward to Okinawa? Do you know?
Well, there wasn't too much moved up there because that was all the combat area.
Yes, sir.
There, and the main body of the headquarters stayed behind. You know, they were a support unit for mm-hmm. those of us who were up in the combat area.
How many of you guys went up there, up to Okinawa?
Well, about half the office, I would say, maybe a dozen of us.
Okay. And can you tell me more about what you saw while you were there?
Well, I saw a lot of these kamikazes flying into ships and airplanes. And
I mean, that had to be a pretty terrible sight.
Oh, yeah, and missing a lot of them, of course. They just hit the ocean, you know.
Yes, sir.
Plus the fact that guns were brought down, some of them, you know.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. That really sticks with you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure. Well, for those of us who've only seen film of it, it's still pretty terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't imagine actually having been right there. Pretty stern stuff, really.
Well, it is exciting.
Well, yes, sir. you wouldn't doze off. I'm sure that's true.
Well,
what were you meant to accomplish while you were there on Okinawa? Were you actually trying to move assets around on the island?
Oh yeah. Well, we were trying to get support units, you know, medical units into
yes.
the island.
Mm-hmm.
To take care of the troops that were actually handling the combat, you know.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a field hospital set up there?
Oh, there were several of them, yeah.
Really? More
mm-hmm.
than one? How many, do you remember?
I don't remember how many, but, you know, as we would push further up the island, they'd put another medical unit up there because of the combat casualties were pretty heavy.
Yes, sir. Were there battalion aid stations? And then also a more fully developed hospital complex.
Oh yeah, and then uh-huh. further back, the big general type hospital. You know?
I see. Wow. Well, how long did you stay on Okinawa? Did you stay there after the battle was
Maybe
over?
6 months.
Okay, so you were there well after the battle.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did the other folks from Numia move up to be with you?
No. No, I went back and joined them after a while.
Okay. And where were you when the war ended?
Trying to remember. I think I was on my way back to the States. But I believe I was still at sea.
What ship were you on? Do you remember?
See, I don't remember because it was one of the smaller ships. Well, it wasn't a small ship. It was not like the big ship I went over on.
Yes, sir.
You know, it was a common freighter-type ship. You know.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Where did you come in?
I came into, into Wilmington, California.
Okay. And by the time you got there, the war was, VJ Day had occurred?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. What, if I can ask you, sir, what did you think about the use of the atomic bomb?
Oh, I was happy. If it had been me, I'd have used it earlier if possible, you know.
Is that right?
I hated the Japanese because of the way they had started the thing. And the number of people that were killed by them, you know. So I had no use for them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I might add, I still don't.
Mm-hmm. Had you, your feelings about them, about the Japanese, had information come to your attention or scuttlebutt come to your ears about, for example, treatment of POWs or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What kinds of things did you hear that kind of fueled that feeling? Do you remember?
Well, I saw some people who had been rescued, and they were walking skeletons.
Where was this?
I'm trying to remember where it was I saw them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was on Okinawa. Uh-huh. They brought them in from somewhere that they had been captured. And, I tell you, several of them were, let's see, they were on ships that were sunk, and they managed to get off alive and were rescued by our people.
Okay.
And they were walking skeletons, you know.
Yeah, it kind of make you sick, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Were you thinking that you would stay with the military after the war was over, or did you have other plans?
No, I didn't have any other plans. I liked the military, so I planned on staying with them. I didn't know that I'd get a regular commission, but after I got back from overseas,
uh-huh.
I was almost immediately sent to the command and staff school up at Leavenworth. And as I remember, there was about 1,000 of us reported in there.
Yep.
And a big class at the command staff school, and they weeded them out pretty fast. So I was lucky enough to get through. Not that great a student, but one of the main problems that we worked on was an actual problem that I had worked on out in the Pacific, and so I lucked out.
Like what? Which problems?
Oh, it was a problem of, had the invasion of Japan come about,
mm-hmm.
But which I might add, I'm glad didn't, because it would have been thousands of us killed trying to storm an island. But anyway, it was a matter of how many people could be moved in there in a certain period of time and what you do with all this stuff. One of the things I can remember is just the rope drop area from the gliders being towed in was tremendous. I don't remember how big an area it took, but a great big one. Anyway, you know, things like that.
Sir, I'm sure that being sent to the command and staff school was a big deal.
For me, it was a big deal,
yes,
yeah,
sir.
Because I hadn't even finished high school at that point.
Yes, sir. It must have also meant for you that you were not going to be demobilized without, you know.
Well, as I said, I think 1,000 of us reported into the command and staff school. And by about the fifth or sixth day, we were down to halfway. So I figured by then I'm fairly safe, you know. But it sort of shook me up, because
mm-hmm.
at that point I think I was still a captain. And
you were a captain at this point?
I think I was a captain at that point.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And there was a colonel sitting on each side of me, and they disappeared. And one in front of me disappeared, and you know, I kept seeing all this rank go,
mm-hmm.
and they were being washed out, and I'm still there, so I figured, well, maybe I'm not as bad as I thought.
Yes, sir. Now, was it your sense that their billets essentially were being cut?
They were being cut out of the class. Anyway, mm-hmm. About two-thirds of the way through the course,
mm-hmm.
they distributed applications for integration into the regular Army to certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept seeing these people get these things and other people disappeared. And I'm still there. I hadn't disappeared, but I hadn't gotten anything either. And one day I got this application for an appointment in the regular Army. So I filled it out and met the board. It was kind of funny because the board I met
mm-hmm.
consisted of a lieutenant general at the head of the board. And there was a bunch of tables set up in U shape, you know.
Yes.
And he sat in the behind the table at one end, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then down each side was a major general on each side, two major generals, I guess, on each side, and then a couple of brigadiers and colonels and on down the line. And and those of us who had been invited to appear before this board sat in the open end of this U-shaped bunch of tables, you know.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
They would ask questions, which we were answering anyway. They'd always ask me, the general was running the thing, would say, now, tell me again, how did you get a commission? And I'd tell them, well, I'm not really sure how I got it, but I told them as well as I could what had happened, you know.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. And so finally, they turned me loose. I got out of there, and luckily, I guess they approved me because I got a regular commission.
Now, did you stay at your same rank?
Yeah, I think I was, by then, I might have been a major at that point.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
When you finished with the command and staff school assignment, where did they send you use your newfound knowledge and your high rank now?
Yeah, let me think. Where did I go? I think I went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, to headquarters of Air Materiel Command. And then, let's see. And then when, oh, yeah, we were called SCARWAR personnel. It's Special Category Army with Air Force, you know, as a personnel identification, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think. And then a year after the Air Force was formed,
yes,
it got its own personnel, you know?
Yes, sir, yes.
And so at that point, I was in the Air Force Surgeon General's office the day it opened.
In 1947 or 48?
48, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm. And what was your position there?
Well, I was still a captain.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I was in charge of the medical personnel assignments and what did they call it? Career control, medical career control division, and the director of staff again education.
I'm making very quick notes so that I can keep up. So. Where were you actually assigned to work? Were you in Washington?
Was in Washington, yeah.
Okay.
We were initially in the Pentagon, and we moved up to what they call, I believe, the McLean Building up. Oh, I've forgotten where it is, up close to Walter Reed up in that area.
Okay, in northern Washington,
mm-hmm.
D.C. Mm-hmm. And, sir, somewhere in here, did you get married?
Yeah, I did. I married the sister-in-law of a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you meet her in Washington, or was it a little later?
Yeah, I met her there.
You met her in Washington?
In Washington. She was visiting her sister and brother-in-law.
Okay. And this is your wife who's there with you?
No, not now.
Oh, okay. What happened?
Well, we were divorced. I don't know why.
Oh, okay.
I was away a lot, you know.
Oh, I see. Yes, sir. And your wife, who's there, whom I've spoken to,
mm-hmm.
You met her later on.
Oh, yeah. I met her in 1950.
Okay. So you had this very short marriage, which didn't work out.
No.
And were you anxious to get out of the Washington area, or did you like it there?
Well, I tell you, I got into trouble there because I was anxious to get out of there.
Yeah.
And when I got a chance to go overseas, I went to Europe. The deputy director of the director that I was assigned to took it as a personal affront because I wouldn't move. He and his boss, the general and this colonel, were moving down to Randolph, to the School of Aviation Medicine, and they invited me to go along with them, and I explained to them that I would rather go overseas if I could, and of course the general said, fine, I mean, sure, I don't blame you,
mm-hmm.
But the other guy took it as an affront and gave me a hard time. Anyway, I went overseas.
Now, where did you go? Germany or where?
In Germany, yeah.
Uh-huh. How long were you there?
Well, let's see, 4 years at that point.
Uh-huh.
Came to the States. Was back in the States for a year and went back for 4 more years.
Now, over there, what were you? What were your assignments?
Well, let's see. When I first got over there, I was assigned to the headquarters. I'm trying to think. The USAFE was a theater, and I was assigned to a headquarters that was to become the headquarters of the Air Force over there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I was my office was in the 12th Air Force Surgeon's Office, which was in Wiesbaden at the time, and then we moved down to Ramstein.
Do you know what year that move took place, or roughly when?
Well, let's see. It must have been, I don't remember.
Was it quite a big deal to make that move from Wiesbaden? I mean, did you have to organize a lot of things previous to making that move?
Yeah, it took a lot of organizing. As a matter of fact, though, they built that headquarters down there where we moved to Ramstein.
Uh-huh.
They built that thing in about 3 months, that whole headquarters.
Is that right?
Yeah, and
yeah, when they decide to do something, they get it done.
Oh, yeah,
that's for sure.
In a hurry, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, were you comfortable in Germany?
Oh, yeah.
How much did you see in terms of residual damage from the
war? There wasn't too much up in the Wiesbaden area and around there, but when you got down to the Ramstein area, that mm-hmm. was in the French section.
Yes.
And the things were still torn up. There were still piles of stuff in the roads. You had to detour around all that stuff. They hadn't cleaned up. The French hadn't allowed them to clean up anything.
You mean like piles of rubble and
mm-hmm.
so on?
Rubble. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so the roads, you just drive around it?
They just go around it as best you could, yeah.
Now, were you forming some kind of impression of the French administratively from this experience?
I had formed the opinion during my initial exposure to them. I decided I didn't want to have much to do with them.
And why was that?
Just didn't like the way they did things.
Or didn't do things.
Or didn't
like.
Do things.
Yes,
didn't
sir.
Allow things to be done.
Yes, sir. Were there Allied personnel, non-American personnel, with you at any of these stations, either Wiesbaden or Ramstein?
Oh, yeah, well, we had, I'm trying to think. We had an outfit called, it was a German outfit called the Labor Service Unit that was set up to buy us, you know, by the American forces
mm-hmm.
as they were supposed to help us with all things, you know. They provided interpreters and, you know, things of this nature.
Yes, uh-huh.
And so we seemed to all get along pretty well.
Except
when we got tangled up with the French.
Is that right?
Well, when we got tangled up with them, things became complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they couldn't say anything in 10 words that they could possibly fit 1,000 into.
Yes, sir. How did you find the Germans? What was their relationship like with the Americans?
Well, we got along pretty well.
Really?
For example, I used to drive from Ramstein up to Wiesbaden, where my wife was. I had married this German girl,
mm-hmm.
and I used to haul these guys up there with me on the weekends, you know, Friday, and then I'd pick them up and bring them back down
mm-hmm.
when I went back on Monday. So we got along fine, you know.
So how did you meet your wife?
I was walking in the park one day
mm-hmm.
in Wiesbaden,
mm-hmm.
and I passed this young lady, and I said hello, and she spoke perfect English. I thought she was an American kid, and, you know, I just said, how you doing, what's your what your father do and all this sort of stuff. Mm. She's German, you know.
Mm. Her English is perfect. I can't hear any accent at all.
Yeah.
But she grew up in Germany.
Oh, yeah. She's German now.
Huh.
But she had an English teacher who was an English lady.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she taught her pretty well.
She sure did.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you meet her family and so on?
Oh, yeah.
As time went on?
Mm-hmm.
What was their experience during the war? Can you tell me anything about that?
Well, her father was a German officer, and he had been captured by he'd been captured initially by us, by the Americans, and was in prison in France. They released him,
mm-hmm.
and I think the Russians then grabbed off a whole train full of released German officers and took them into Russia and kept them another 3 or 4 years.
And so he wasn't... he was not released until well after the end of the war, then?
Yeah, at least 4 years after.
No kidding.
Well.
Gosh, how awful. Where was he kept in Russia? Do you know, in the Soviet Union?
I have no idea. I don't know where, but some...
Was he able to or willing to talk to you about it at all?
Oh, yeah, but I've forgotten where
sure.
he said he was, but he didn't like to talk about it.
I understand that, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure you did, too.
Yeah.
Very difficult times.
Yeah.
Now, let's see, you said you've been married, what, 52 years now?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's quite something, and congratulations on that.
Thank you.
It seems that your time in Germany, which I think you said you spent something like 8 years there in the
mm-hmm.
19... This would be throughout the 1950s, mostly.
Yeah.
Went very well.
Oh, yeah.
Now, were you promoted in rank while you were over there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I told you, when I initially went over, the general and the colonel
yes.
had moved down to Randolph,
yes, sir.
Where the general became the commandant at the School of Aviation Medicine.
Uh-huh.
He approved of me going over there and everything, so I got along fine with him.
Sure.
But his deputy, the colonel,
yeah.
took it as a personal affront.
Yes.
And he wrote the only bad ER I ever received.
Oh, boy. Uh-huh.
So that gives you an idea how it got along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he just couldn't get over it, apparently.
No.
Did he eventually kind of get out of the way, retiring
well,
or something?
Eventually. Thank God they caught up with him. He was using drugs, and they kicked him out of the service.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. But in the meantime, he did a lot of harm to me.
In terms of that personnel report?
Oh, yeah.
And also probably talking?
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know about it because I was overseas and he was back in the States.
Sure.
And the Surgeon General of the Air Force at the time was a man named Dan Ogle. And I had known him for years. And so as a Surgeon General, he came over to inspect one time, and he called me and said, "Tom, I'm coming. I want to show you something." And I went into his office, and he laid this effectiveness report out and said, "Now I want you to get busy and get this thing out of your file."
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lousy report there for several years, you know.
Now, how do you go about getting something like that buried?
Well, I had to get a lot of witnesses to give me certificates, you know, statements, and I had to write a letter and point out that what had happened. And finally, they threw the report out.
So you had to you had to get people to sign affidavits. And
oh
so
yeah,
on?
Yeah. But in the meantime, it had mm-hmm. cost me 2, 3, or 4 years promotion service, you know.
Yes. Uh huh. Now, this was Dan Hogle.
Ogle, O-G-L-E.
O-G-L-E. Now, where did you know him from?
I don't know. I think I knew General Ogle from almost the time I came into the service.
Is that right?
I met him somewhere, and we were talking. I think we were on an airplane together or something. I was sitting side by side. I was talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And also, he was a personal friend of the doctor who had gotten me into the medical service.
So he was in the background,
mm-hmm.
kind of I don't want to say mentor because it's maybe not that close, but he was on your side, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Now, did he call you Tommy?
Yeah.
Does everybody call you Tommy?
Most people did, yeah.
Okay. did you, who gave you that? Did they just start calling you that because of your last name?
Because my last name,
sure,
I guess.
Sure. And had they called you that during World War II?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. It just kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. After your time at Rammstein, what was your next assignment? Did you come back to the States?
Yeah, came back to the States for a year, as I remember,
mm-hmm.
then went right back over.
Okay, so you were back and forth to Germany quite
mm-hmm.
a bit.
Yeah.
Now, Colonel, when did it happen that you went back out to the Pacific?
Trying to think. It wasn't until Vietnam.
And until the U.S. was already actually in Vietnam, so the middle 60s?
Yeah.
Okay. Before that, where were you coming from? Do you remember your assignment before that?
Well, yeah, I was assigned. My assignment was a headquarters was in Hawaii.
Yes, sir.
I ran the aeromedical evacuation service in the Pacific.
Starting from what date, do you remember?
Oh, gee. I don't really remember.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this before we get started on that. Let me ask you, what was the origin, if you can tell me a little bit about this, of airborne medical evacuations? Had those been happening in...
Well, actually, that had been happening in a very unorganized way before the war started. You know, we'd take a patient up, let's say, from Barksdale, where I was,
uh-huh.
up to maybe Hot Springs, you know, where the Army Navy General Hospital was.
Yes, sir.
And we'd take them maybe up to Walter Reed, you know, we'd fly them up, you know, sometime I'd go along as an attendant, things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it had been done on a very informal basis, you know, I guess ever since it had been an Air Corps, you know.
I understand, sure. Uh-huh. But kind of, as you say, just one patient at a time on a...
Yeah, usually. Just,
ad hoc basis, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
No system for it.
No system at that point. No,
okay.
The first system... It really came about was during the war when they had a squadron, as I recall, in each theater. I know there was one out there in the Pacific. They had nothing to do with it at the time.
Yes.
But
okay.
I know they were transporting patients from one island to another. You know, for instance, they brought them out of Guadalcanal.
And did they bring them from, for example, from Guadalcanal down to New Caledonia?
Oh yeah, New Caledonia.
Okay. And this was on a more or less regular basis.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
With dedicated aircraft.
Yeah.
And dedicated onboard crews.
Oh yeah.
Crews?
People. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Uh huh. When
yeah, I didn't have anything to do with it.
Right. Understood. Understood. Yes, sir. Just trying to get a sense of when this idea began to gel and when the.
Well, it began to. As soon as there was it combat, I know that it did it early in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They moved patients around in Europe, brought them back to England and off by air for a long time.
Yes, sir.
And out in the Pacific, they brought them out of Guadalcanal and took them down to New Cal and on and down into New Zealand, places we had, you know, bigger and better hospitals.
Yes. Now, the U.S. installations, the Air Force installations in Germany,
mm-hmm.
at Wiesbaden and Rammstein, did they also have, even though we weren't necessarily in a shooting war at that time, had airstrips there and where they would take in patients?
Oh yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And was it considered medical evacuation really, or was
it
was. So this system was something that developed, continued
it
to develop.
It developed during the war, yeah,
uh-huh.
into a formal organizations, you know.
Okay, and by the time you came to Hawaii...
By the time I came to Hawaii, I was running the thing out in the Pacific.
For essentially all of the Pacific command?
Yeah, bringing, for instance, every patient that came out of the Pacific, from the time I got out there, this was after the war, during the Vietnam thing mostly.
Yes.
Came back through my outfit. You know, I ran that many. We used 141 airplanes before that, C-97s, and brought them back to the States over several different routes, you know.
Yes. Well, sir, let's take a break there.
Well,
now, Colonel, let me ask you, were you aware and paying much attention to the buildup in Vietnam? Did you know that there was going to be a conflict there of major proportions?
Well, I began to suspect that there would be, and by that time I had become very interested in the movement of patients by air. So, I kind of saw a little of it during the main war, you know, and then between wars, it moved patients a little bit. But by the time Vietnam came along, I was convinced that that we needed some organized way to get them back to the States. Like they had a within theater air evac unit that operated, you know, from Japan down to different places, you know, and could bring them out of Vietnam into Japan. But then it had to be a better way of getting them back to the States than just you know, by luck. So I set about trying to organize a system to get them back to the States. So I brought all the patients that got back to the United States from the Vietnamese thing, and, you know, and all that area got back through my outfit.
Now, you were running all of this from Hawaii. From what base, sir? Where were you based?
Hickam.
And what were your accommodations like? At this point, you're pretty far up the food chain.
Yeah.
So were you a colonel yet or a lieutenant colonel?
I was when I started a lieutenant colonel, and right after we got started, I made colonel.
Okay.
Yeah. And, of course, I had three units in Vietnam that I set up, you know, to move patients directly back to the States, as well as units done in Japan, and then I had a unit in Okinawa too.
Yes.
So I had thought about this a lot. I decided kind of early in the game, after World War II, that I wanted to be in the evacuation business.
But you wanted to specialize there?
I wanted to specialize in moving patients by air.
I see.
So by the time Vietnam came along, I had a pretty good outfit set up, you know. So I had three units in Vietnam. I had one at Cameron Bay, one at Tan Sanut, one at Da Nang.
Now, did you ever go and actually put your boots on the ground over there to visit those units?
Oh, absolutely.
I thought probably.
Yeah. Now, as a matter of fact, I got shot down over there in Vietnam, and that's what's my problem now. I got heavily dosed with Agent Orange.
Now, tell me about the shoot down, if you will, sir. What happened? Where were you?
Well, as a matter of fact, I was hitchhiking from one place in Vietnam to another. I was going up to visit some of the hospitals.
Yes, sir.
So I was hitchhiking with a friend of mine who was a helicopter pilot.
Yes.
And we got diverted to pick up a crew that had been shot down. And we got right over that crew, and they did the same thing to us. They shut our rotor off, and we fell almost right in on top of the people we had been sent out to get. And so they sent another chopper out to get the two crews who were down there now, and they got shot down too. So now that we got three crews down there, and in the meantime, they sprayed us heavily because the outfit called the Ranch Hands, the ones that did the the spraying against the leaves and stuff, you know.
Yes.
Didn't know we were down there. So they drenched us real good. And
do you remember it falling on you?
Oh, yeah. It was just like rain, you know.
Mm-hmm. Where did this, where was the shoot down? Where did this happen, sir? And do you know when, what year?
The year?
Uh-huh.
Gee. My memory of the times is kind of bad.
Oh, that's okay. Do you know where it happened? Were you up north?
Yeah, I was.
Central Highlands, or where were you?
I was flying from one position in Vietnam to another.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I'm trying to think of where. I was going up to the 7th Evacuation Hospital, I believe, or I had been at the 7th and was going up to another one
uh-huh.
when we got diverted over to pick up a crew that had been shot down.
Yeah.
And we got shot down.
Now, when you were shot down, can you just, I mean, I know this is probably very difficult, but it might be interesting for people listening to know what you went through in terms of the aircraft going down. How did it behave, and what did you do to so that you weren't?
Well, it happened so fast,
uh-huh.
you really couldn't tell what happened, except we were right over the treetops, you know?
Yes,
just
yes.
Almost the treetop level.
Okay.
When they knocked our rotor off, shut
yes.
the rotor off, you know?
Uh-huh.
So we just went kaplunk right down.
Straight down?
Yeah.
Okay.
And almost fell right on the outfit that we were
yeah.
going in there to get.
Yes, sir.
And the same thing happened to the next airplane.
Were you much hurt in this?
No, I just shook up a little bit, but you know, because we only fell from the, just right over the top of the trees, down through the trees, which somewhat broke the fall, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we hit the ground with a sort of a thud, and that was it, you know. Kind of shook up a little. We rolled out of the airplane and begin to think about how to get out. When they sent another airplane in to get us, they did the same with them.
And how did you avoid being hit by that plane? Did it come down in a slightly different position than where you were?
Just, you know, maybe 25, 30 feet away.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the guys in that aircraft? Were they hurt?
No, they were like us. They just shook up and annoyed more than anything.
Yes, sir, I'm sure they were. I'm sure. I believe it. I bet you all were.
Yeah.
Now on the ground, there are however many of you there were, what, 10 or 12 or maybe more?
Well, let's see. There was 1, 2, 3. Yeah, there was about 14 of us.
And what did you guys do to sort of protect yourselves while you were there? Of course, there's nothing you can do about it being sprayed.
Well, there wasn't much we could do about that.
Yeah.
And because the spraying outfit, which I call the ranch hands,
yes,
they
sir.
Didn't know we were down there, see?
Yes, sir.
So they came in to spray all this foliage,
mm-hmm.
and they got us. It's just like being out in the rain, you know, because they sprayed real heavy.
Yes, sir.
And in the meantime, they sent a bigger chopper in to get us, you know.
And was that chopper?
And all, first off, before they could do that, they had to get what they call a gunship, which is a C-47.
Yes.
With a 75-millimeter gun mounted in it.
Uh-huh.
But I had it orbiting up there, finally keeping the bad guys away from us, you know.
Okay, yes. This had to be a little nerve-wracking.
Well, a little bit.
Uh-huh. When the rescue aircraft was able to get down to the ground,
mm-hmm.
were there any injured men there with you?
Oh, yeah. The first chopper that went in,
uh-huh.
There was one guy killed, and let's see, I think we had one with one broken leg and a broken arm.
And you got him onto the aircraft first.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure. Were you all able to get onto the single chopper that landed to get you out of there?
Yeah, because they sent a pretty good size one in.
Okay,
yeah
I see. And do you remember where they took you?
Well, I'm trying to think.
The hell out of there, for one thing. But
we got out of there, yeah. That was the main thing.
Yes, sir.
Getting out, yeah. I think we went right to Da Nang from
mm-hmm.
there. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
No. We went to one of the stations on the coast, and I've forgotten which one.
Okay. And, of course, that the wounded guy with the broken limbs.
Oh, yeah. We shook him off first, and they had to send an ambulance, and they stuck him in the ambulance. They took him off to the hospital.
Okay. Did you have to go through any kind of debriefing or anything because you'd been on the ground?
Oh, yeah. They wanted to know how it happened, and, you know.
Sure.
We told them as best we could how it happened.
Sure. Were you able to continue the tour that you were on, or did this kind of...
No, I continued the tour. I went on up, as a matter of fact, and found out a bunch of patients were coming from. We had wondered where the patients were going to be. You know, when you're moving a bunch of patients, it's well to know where they come from and where you're going to take them, you know?
Yes, sir.
And it stops in route.
Yes, you need a plan. Yes, sir.
I wanted to know where they were coming from, so we'd know where, are they coming from a big unit, a small unit, or, you know, is there going to be a lot of them or a few or what? So that's what I had been doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was able to continue doing that.
Now, was it useful to you as the sort of senior commander of the evac operation on the back end to see what was happening on the ground in the front end? Was it useful to you in making decisions and allocating resources and so on?
Well, yeah, that was one of the reasons I spent so much time up there, because it was very difficult to get accurate information. You know, things... you know, with all the fancy equipment and all the stuff that we have, it was very difficult. If you were on one side of the hill and the outfit is on the other side, it's very difficult to talk to them over the phone lines, you know?
Yes, sir, yes.
So the only way you could be sure was to see how big a unit's up there and what they're exposed to, you know?
What kind of fire they were taking, and therefore what kind of casualties they were likely to have.
That's right. You know, roughly, you know, how many you could expect over a period of time and what type they would be.
Yes, sir. How long did you actually spend in Vietnam itself?
Well, let's see. I spent...
did you go a couple different times or just
one? I would spend about half each month up there.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then back to Hawaii?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow. For how long, sir? How long did this go on?
Well, let's see. It went on for 2 or 3 years.
So you were back and forth a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You put in a lot of air time.
Oh, you better believe, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I think by the time I retired, I had 23,000 hours in the air. Of course, a lot of that goes back to the old prop days, you know.
Yes, sir, when they had took more hours to cross the same distance.
Oh, yeah.
But when you would fly into and out of Vietnam, would you mostly come in and out of Da Nang, or where would you?
Well, sometimes I'd go into Da Nang, sometimes I'd go into Cam Ranh Bay, sometimes into,
Tansanut.
Pardon?
Tansanut.
Yeah, Tansanut.
Now, did you get into Saigon much?
Oh, yeah. Got into Saigon quite often.
What did you...
That's a good restaurant down there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You had a favorite?
Oh, it was a French restaurant. They were good.
Quite good?
Oh, yeah.
What was the protocol for you in terms of your own personal security moving around in Saigon? I mean, did you carry a sidearm?
I sure did.
And what were you, what did you expect? I mean, were you kind of on alert while you were there, or?
Well, I'll tell you what happened.
Okay.
My deputy and I went in there together because when we first got involved in this thing, we wanted to know, you know, who we needed to see, what we needed to see, and, so we went together, which is not a good idea, but we had to do it because we didn't have much time.
Okay.
So we were billeted in a place called the Brinks Hotel.
Yes, sir.
And I think we were on the fifth floor or something like that. And I think we had checked into our room around 11 o'clock at night or something like that. And about an hour later, as I recall, something hit the hotel, and we didn't have a wall overlooking the street, you know. We could just look out of our room right down on the street, you know. So then we had a problem of getting out of there. So we went down 2 flights of steps, and that discontinued. So then we had to crawl through windows and, you know, work our way down to the ground. So our reception into there at the time was rather rigid, you know.
Did anyone die in that attack, sir? Do you know?
As far as I know, nobody died. Scared, but not died.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That must have been quite a wake-up call for what you were dealing with.
Pardon?
With what you were dealing with.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, my deputy was not a hero. He's not the kind that can be shot at and then laugh about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't much appreciate it.
No, sir. I can actually believe that.
Yeah.
About what time do you roughly know when that was? In other words, was it before the U.S. had committed troops in a big way, or was it a little bit later as the buildup was occurring?
Oh, it was a little later after the buildup had occurred.
Okay,
yeah.
I see. What was your sense generally of the conflict itself, and did you have thoughts on whether this was a winnable war, or?
Well, I'll tell you, frankly, my question to myself is, what the hell are we doing here?
Yes, sir.
You know, that's the way I felt about the whole thing. But since we're here, we got to do what we're expected to do.
Of course, sure.
And also, that was my attitude towards the whole thing.
But did it kind of worry you a bit, the setup,
Well, it bothered me because you couldn't get any reliable information.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out rather early in the game, if we're going to bring any patients out of there directly back to the States,
mm-hmm.
then I'm going to have to get up there and find out where these patients are coming from, because the information you can get through channels just isn't reliable. And, you know, they'd tell me there'd be 50 patients, and we'd send enough transportation in to get 50 patients, and
mm-hmm.
there'd be 250, you know, things like that. So I figured I got to get on the ground up there and see what's going on.
Now, was it something that you found you could, being on the ground, get good information about, or was it that it was unpredictable?
Well, and up to a point, it's unpredictable, but the only way you could get anything close to accurate
uh-huh.
accuracy was to be up there and see it for yourself. You
wow.
know?
Wow.
Because the information just wasn't reliable. There's like the body count over there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Some outfits gave good body counts and others padded them, you know, some missed them, you know, things like that.
And that would really tend to mess up your planning.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. And a lot of wasted space or not enough space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. When you were back in Hawaii, did you ever feel anxious or like maybe you didn't want to go back, especially after that shoot down incident? Maybe you didn't. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, when I would leave Hawaii, I'd just hope that things had improved enough where I was going, it wasn't going to happen again, but it didn't improve. So.
It didn't really, did it?
No.
Did you have a feeling that as things kind of ground on, that it wasn't going anywhere? That the conflict
was... I always wondered, what are we doing here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get a good answer to that, sir?
No.
Did you ever, even now, do you feel like you...
I still don't know why we were there.
No kidding. Well, that says a lot about our.
Yeah, well, things just happened. Just seemed to develop. It seemed to me there was no planning. It was just it's happening and that's it.
Right, and now react.
Yeah.
To it. Mm. Well, that's tough when you're in the business that you were in.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask about the patient transport system, if you don't mind, sir.
Sure.
I think this is real interesting. you were particularly keen on making good arrangements such that combat injury personnel could get back to the U.S.
Yeah.
What hospitals were the primary recipients of direct casualties from Vietnam in the U.S.? Which hospitals?
Well, the ones that we brought back from Vietnam, we brought back over several routes.
Okay.
First off, one route, of course, was the northern route, which is up through Alaska,
uh-huh.
you know, through Anchorage and on down. And we dropped off a lot of those patients at Great Lakes Naval Hospital.
Okay.
And brought some on down to the Washington area and as far down as Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama.
Okay.
And that's where the mission terminated, you know.
I see, yes.
All right, then other missions, we'd bring back other routes.
Uh-huh.
Some would come right back through Guam and Hawaii and that area, and some would come straight across, you know.
Okay, uh-huh.
So we had several different routes that we used. And,
yeah.
And what we tried to do is load the patients on the aircraft that was going into the area that they needed to be sent to. See, there's a medical regulating office which says this patient goes to this hospital, this patient goes to that hospital, and so forth. So we had to put them on the route that took them into the hospitals where they were supposed to go.
And some other office would make the decision about what hospital they would be being taken
to? Yeah,
that
was what they call a medical regulating office.
Where were they located? Was that actually in Vietnam on the ground? Or?
No, it was in Japan.
Okay. And they would make those decisions?
They made the decision of which hospital a patient went to. And we took them to those to the areas they were supposed to go to.
Okay. And when they would come back via, when let's say the aircraft were coming back via Guam and Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
And maybe then to the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
what hospitals would be the ones receiving the patients put on those aircraft?
Well, generally speaking, those that went to Great Lakes,
uh-huh.
they were put on the aircraft that went back through Alaska, you know.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And down that way, those that went to Walter Reed and on down as far as Maxwell Air Force Base,
uh-huh.
you know, they were put on that aircraft.
Uh-huh.
And others that were going, let's say, to the hospital in California. That way, they would come straight across, either through Guam and Hawaii and on in, or either directly into Washington and down the coast. You know.
Okay. And what about young men who might be being sent to hospitals in Texas, for example?
In Texas.
Yeah.
Well, they usually came back the southern route through California. You know,
mm-hmm.
to Hawaii and California.
I see. Uh huh. And I mean, this sounds like again a major organizational effort to make sure that the right person got on the right aircraft.
Oh yeah.
And so you had to have good people working.
Oh, I had people. Yeah, I had offices at each place. That their job was to be sure that the right patient got on the right airplane. You know.
Did you have that you know of, Colonel, standout people under you?
Oh yeah.
And if so, do you remember any of their names?
Oh yeah.
I
can remember.
Okay.
I had a warrant officer who was with me the whole way over. I'd move him into all the key positions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can't even remember his name.
That's okay. We'll give you another chance later on.
Yeah.
But you had good people working under you.
Oh,
it sounds like.
Yeah.
Because this couldn't.
If I didn't, I got rid of them.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
We couldn't tolerate any mistakes.
No, sir. You're dealing with very, very delicate situations here.
Absolutely.
I'm sure. Did you see? Did you yourself see many casualties going on to aircraft? Did you actually try to get out that far?
Oh yeah.
Can you tell me about that experience of seeing those young men?
Well, I tell you, it's bad because, you know, you'd see a guy. Well, let me give you one of the most graphic ones.
Okay.
going out as a young guy on the airplane that I was deadheading out on. And he sat in the seat right next to me. And I think this was on a Tuesday, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
On Thursday, I got on an airplane to come back. This time I was going through Alaska and on down to the East Coast, you know, mm-hmm. dropping off patients. And this kid was on there minus a leg and an arm. Same one that had gone out with me 2 or 3 days before. That wakes you up.
Yes, sir. That's pretty sad.
Yeah. Well, that's about the most extreme one I can think of. The reason I remember that one so well is because we were sitting in seats side by side going out,
mm-hmm.
and I talking to him, you know, and all, and then coming back to the same kid, you know.
But what was his, if you remember talking to him, what was his demeanor going out to Vietnam? I mean, how did a young guy...
Oh, he was looking forward to it.
Was he?
Yeah. You know, he was one of these star-eyed, you know, he really wanted to get out there and see what was going on and be a part of it.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And probably give him, you know, give the enemy hell.
Yeah.
Well, that's tough, but it shows that you were actually in the thick of it, not...
Oh, yeah.
You know, not just... you didn't stay in Hawaii the whole time.
Talk about the thick of it. I was sitting in my unit at Da Nang, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I had a trailer that was surrounded by a wall. With two walls, actually. One was right next to the trailer, all the way around it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the next wall was about 3 feet out from that, and between those two walls was filled with sand, see.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And sitting in there one evening when a shell fell right in on top of us, you know.
Did it go off?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Nobody was hurt. You wouldn't believe it, you know. We were sitting there, the thing blew out the whole thing, and none of us were hurt.
None of you?
None of us.
That's just unbelievable.
I mean, you know, we were shook up.
Oh, sure.
The thing is, this trailer had one, the office was in the front,
mm-hmm.
and the guys who ran the office lived in the back, see,
yeah.
of this trailer.
Yeah.
And it hit in the back. Fortunately, there was nobody in the back. We were all up front. It blew the back out, and we were up there with no problem. So.
But you would have, it would have been a completely different story if you'd have been in the back.
Oh, yeah. Or if the shell had landed up front.
Yes, sir.
Everything worked out in our favor, you know.
Well, I can't help but think that you're a very, I don't know, maybe you have very good luck or something.
I must have.
Because I haven't talked to very many people who were shot down. And got out of it, you know, essentially the same day.
Yeah.
Not to mention the other two aircraft beyond your own that were also shot down in the same place. It's just unbelievable. and then you're taking rocket fire.
Oh yeah.
While we're on that subject, did you have an impression? You know, we talked about the Japanese. Did you have an impression of the Vietnamese? That the United States was fighting against. Did you have a sense of the enemy, like who the enemy was?
Well, you know, in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
everything seemed to be sort of normal when there wasn't any attacks right close by.
Right.
You know, business went on as usual, and you could buy more GI equipment on the street than you could get from a military warehouse.
Yes, sir. I've heard that. Yes, sir.
You know, and things seemed to be fine and dandy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other hand, when things went awry, everything went wrong. For example, my man this was the warrant officer I was telling about.
Yeah.
He lived on what they call... 10P Alley, And he lived about, well, down at the end of Tempe Alley was the 17th Field Hospital.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And he and I were walking down there, which would bring us right by his, where he lived. We were walking down towards the hospital, and all of a sudden, a bunch of the black guys, the guys in the little black uniforms or pajamas,
uh-huh,
were behind us shooting at us, you know? And there was a dog ahead of us, and the dog apparently recognized these shots. Maybe he had been shot at before, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw him go under the fence. And there was a hole there that you'd swear a good-sized cat couldn't get through, and both of us went through it. That tells you how you adapt to things, you know.
To get out of there?
Yeah, well, no. Yeah, we got out and went around the other way and came out down at the hospital where we alerted everybody and each other, and we got into position to defend the hospital, and mm-hmm, nothing happened.
Did you have a sense of how many gunmen there were?
I don't think there were more than three or four.
Really? Were they shooting directly at you?
Oh, yeah.
Down that alley?
Oh, that alley. On one side was houses, mm-hmm, you know, brick houses,
mm-hmm,
and on the other side was a brick wall. That's the hole, where the hole was that we went under. And the bullets were ricocheting off that thing like nobody's business, and like hailstones off the...
Good gracious. This is yet further evidence for the fact that I think you've been very, very lucky, sir.
Oh, I've been really lucky, I tell you.
I mean, to not take a bullet there... That just sounds like an absolute setup for two dead Americans.
It would have been if that hole hadn't been there.
Yes, sir.
We wouldn't have been able to get out of there because it was a high fence, and then on the other side was houses which were locked up.
Right. Yeah, walls. You couldn't get through.
No.
Well, it was a darn good thing you watched that dog.
I saw that dog go under that fence. I figured I can get under there too, yeah.
Yes, sir.
So we did.
Yes, sir. Were you thinking as the war went on that the United States was making progress and actually building up the South Vietnamese army, our allies?
No, I really couldn't see any sense to the whole thing. To me, it just seems so ridiculous. I kept asking myself, "What in the world are we doing here?"
Did you have an opinion about President Johnson's management of the war?
I sometimes wondered if anybody was managing it.
Anybody at all?
Anybody at all? You know, is this something that's just happening? You know, with no direction, or is the direction really this bad? You know.
Well, I can imagine you did. I can imagine thinking that after having been in World War II, where it was very clear what the objectives were, and this was a different kind of conflict.
Yeah, well, you know, in during World War II, even when fighting in heavy jungle or cities or whatever,
mm-hmm,
you could every now and then see the enemy, you know?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Now, this thing, you never saw the enemy. You didn't know. If you did, he might be standing next to you.
Yeah, that had to be very frustrating.
Yeah.
Not to mention, frightening. I mean, I would think.
Yeah.
If you had your wits about you,
yeah,
it would be a little frightening.
Like I said, it was so silly during periods of relative normalcy in Saigon, for instance, everything went on as usual. You know, you could,
sure,
buy more stuff off the street than you could get from military warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
You could get good food, and, you know, everything was fine. But when things went to pot, it really went to pot.
Did you feel like the work that you were doing was making an important difference, at least for the men?
Well, I figured it was for the people we were moving out because they had died otherwise.
Well, sure. But, you know, speaking of the kind of disorganization or apparent disorganization of the war, at least you got your part right. Was that kind of how you felt?
Yeah, I felt good. I felt like we were doing our part and doing it well,
mm-hmm,
because we got all the patients out of there.
Yes.
That we were, you know, that that we could get to, or that got to us, and we got them to their destinations, and that's about all I could expect, you know.
Well, and that's quite a lot. It really is. Colonel, who did you report to for most of this time?
Well, there were two people I reported to. One of them, well, actually, there's more than that.
Okay.
My real boss was, I'm trying to think what his name was. Anyway, I can't remember.
That's okay.
The guy that I was directly responsible to,
yes,
was the commander of the unit in Hawaii.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But he was not a medical man. So the doctor I was responsible to was the MAC surgeon, and he was back at Scott Air Force Base.
Okay.
So, but I never saw him every now and then. I talked to him on the telephone maybe once a month, something
right.
like that.
Right. But you didn't you didn't require a lot of oversight from him from his point of view.
No, there wasn't much he could do because
right.
he was back there and the action was there, you know.
Were you authorized to go in and out of Vietnam just as many times as you felt you needed to?
Absolutely.
Okay. And you, do you have a sense of how many times you were in and out of the country?
Oh, my God. I would say two or three times every month over a period of two, 3 years.
What was the least secure of the areas? Was it Saigon or was it Cameron Bay area? Where did you think was least secure for U.S. personnel? Not combat personnel, but folks like you who were
people,
doing
yeah.
support jobs.
I would say somewhere around Da Nang and in that area.
Okay. Uh huh. Actually, that doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah, that was it was very tough up there.
Yeah. And the odd things would happen.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there was a path from the flight line down to my, I told you about this trailer we
sure.
had set up with this sand wall around it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a path from the flight line down to there. And this path was as bare as your floor, you know?
Yes.
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
But on each side of this path was only about maybe a foot and a half wide, you know, and it was bare dirt. And on each side, though, was reeds and, you know, grass and stuff. It was shoulder high or even higher, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you go down through there. And one day I was going down through there, and I thought I saw a stick sticking up right in the middle of the path, about maybe 6 or 8 yards in front of me.
Okay.
It was a snake.
It was a snake?
Oh, yeah. It was a cobra. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening to you.
It was a cobra.
Yes, sir.
I walked down there thinking this was a snake, mm-hmm. A stick in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a darn cobra. I got down there, he flattened his head out, and I blew it off.
You got your gun out?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good for you. I'm just deathly afraid of snakes, so that's why I went all quiet.
Yeah.
I'm trying to imagine that. Yeah. So you blew his head off?
Blew his head off, yeah.
Oh, God. Colonel, let me ask you what impression you formed, if any, of the South Vietnamese government and the military structure that we were trying to support there in Vietnam. Did you?
Well, I don't think we knew what military structure we were trying to support. It seemed like there was no real distinction between those we were trying to help and those we were trying to harm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't tell them apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me everything was just that way.
And it felt that way the whole time you were there?
Absolutely.
Do you remember much about the Tet Offensive?
Oh, yeah.
Were you in country or?
I was in country for two of them.
Okay. Which ones? The ones in 1968? The big ones that were
yeah,
reported?
Yeah, I was there.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, my man that was stationed there ran my unit in, mm-hmm. in Saigon at that time, and I had been to this French restaurant I was telling you about yeah. downtown.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And we were being hauled back out to where he lived in one of these bicycles with a sort of a chair in front, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
You've seen those things,
yes,
probably.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Anyway, we were paddling down the street there, and all of a sudden, all hell broke loose, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You never knew what was going to happen.
Were you caught up in the...
Well, okay. Right in front of the embassy.
Yes, sir.
The bad guys had decided to attack the embassy just as we passed in front of it.
What happened? What did you see?
We told this guy was peddling that thing to uh-huh. really put on the heat, you know. He went down as far as he could, and then we jumped out and went across, kind of across the country.
Now, again, you had your sidearm with you?
Oh, yeah.
Were you ready to use it?
I was ready to use it. Unfortunately, that time I didn't have to.
Mm.
We outran it.
Wow. Well, how long did you stay in Hawaii? I mean, how long was this appointment, this assignment? About 3 years?
No, longer than that.
Was it?
I think it was about 4 years.
When did it end? Do you know roughly? I know you indicated to us that your retirement came in like 1973, I think.
Yeah.
So did you have another assignment after your time in Hawaii?
Yeah, I did. I was assigned to headquarters MAC.
To headquarters where?
MAC.
Okay, so that would be in Washington.
No, this was at Scott Air Force Base.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Do you remember much about the work that you did there?
Yeah, I was supposed to be the guy planning all the, you know, what the guy who took my place was supposed to be doing.
Right.
You know,
and that work continued while you were assigned at Scott.
Yeah.
Uh
huh. Yeah.
Did you take an active role in overseeing what he was doing?
Oh yeah, I had to make two or three trips out there again just to be sure everything was going the way it was supposed to.
And how you had set it up, essentially.
Yeah, because
uh-huh.
this is something that had not been set up before. See, I became interested in moving patients by air
mm-hmm.
after seeing them moved in large numbers during the war, you know?
Sure, during World War II.
During World War II.
Yes, sir.
And I talked to people who had participated in that in Europe, you know. And when, of course, I could see about where I was, but I wasn't involved in it directly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I decided I wanted to do.
Yes, sir.
You know, so then I began to plan how to get into it and how to get it to run, you know, to impress people, to make them believe this is the way to do things. So, you know, it just kind of sprang from there.
Yes. And the system that you set up sounds like it was one of, you know, it was extremely effective for those young men who needed it.
It was, and at first it was rather complicated because I had to convince people that I needed to have airplanes run certain directions, you know,
routes.
Uh-huh. And the people who were running the airplanes, who were responsible for that, didn't necessarily want to do that. For instance, they had boxes that wanted to go, you know, south, and I had patients that wanted to go east. Something had to give, you know.
And how did you win the argument?
Well, I just go to the boss
uh-huh.
and work my way up the line until I got to the real top man.
Yes, sir.
And tell him that this is what's happening, you know. These are your people that are getting shot up out there.
Yes, sir.
You know, and you want them moved or you want the damn boxes moved?
Yes, sir. Well, I'm very grateful that you are the one who prevailed.
Well, they some of them didn't like me because of that, but others
sure.
did, you know. Finally, I had a pretty good reputation.
Yes. Well, sir, how did you decide to retire. Can you talk to me about your decision to retire?
Well, you know, you have to retire at a certain point. Uh-huh. And I was held over 3 years beyond my mandatory retirement date because the surgeon and the Surgeon General convinced the whoever decides these things in the Air Force headquarters that they needed me for 3 more years. So I was held 3 years beyond my normal retirement date.
Now, were you upset about that, or was it fine with you?
Oh, it's fine with me.
Yeah.
I liked what I was doing.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. And so you your retirement almost coincided with the end of the war in some ways.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you felt about the United States peace agreements that were signed at Paris with North Vietnam and the end of the war, how things developed? Did you support what the United States had done, what President Nixon decided to do?
Well, a lot of the stuff that apparently was decided to be done, I couldn't see much point in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I couldn't help but wonder, what the heck are we doing here?
Sure.
In the first place, you know?
Yes, sir.
And beyond that, yeah, we did all that, you know, that could be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since we were involved, you have to either fish or cut bait, you know?
I understand. Yes,
and
sir.
So I figured since we got to do the best we can.
And did you think that it was time to get out when...
Oh, yeah.
When we did?
Yeah.
Or pastime, even?
I feel the same way about that. I felt the same way about that as I feel about what's going on right now.
In Iraq?
In Iraq.
Uh-huh.
I think we have no business being there.
Uh-huh.
We should leave and drop a big bomb as we leave.
And just get rid of the whole problem?
Just get rid of the whole problem. The whole thing isn't worth a dime. It isn't worth one American life, let alone the number that has been taken care of.
And Colonel, does it seem like the same kind of conflict where there's no win? There's no...
Absolutely. Seems like there's no end to it,
mm-hmm.
and we could be there forever. And things are happening right now like they happened 100 years ago.
Like
and
what?
Like they'll happen 100 years from now.
I see. Uh-huh. No change.
No change.
That has to be a little frustrating for you as a military man to see to feel that same kind of discouraging feeling about the prospects for this conflict.
Well, look, the whole place, right, as far as I'm concerned right now, everything in the Middle East isn't worth one American life.
Because it's just such a mess?
It's such a mess. It has been for hundreds and hundreds of years, and will be for the next hundreds and hundreds of years in spite of all our efforts. And we're losing people where we have no business even being.
Understood, yeah, yeah. And you did you not support, were you against this, like, from the beginning? At the time that President Bush decided to place, you know, a lot of American troops in Iraq, did you think, oh, this isn't such a good idea?
I thought that's a lousy idea.
Yeah. What about the war in Afghanistan? Was that a different...
It's the same thing.
Really?
They've been doing things their way for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be doing things their way for the next 100 years. And what we're going to do, what we are doing, is losing a lot of good American lives in a situation that we can have no influence on whatever.
It'll be the same when we leave as when we got
it'll
there?
It'll be just like it was before.
Sir, let me ask you a little bit if I can. And this is, of course, just as everything is, up to you to say, but I know that you have suffered from the effects of that dousing of Agent Orange that you took.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, are you working with the Veterans Administration Hospital?
I'm a patient there with them.
Yes. I just wondered if that's where your care was being given.
Yeah.
And go ahead, sir.
No, I say that's where I get my medical care.
Okay. I wanted to check on that. And then just to ask you whether you think that the VA hospitals are being appropriately funded. Do you have enough support
Well, I think they're being adequately funded. I'm not saying that they are being adequately run. I think there's a lot of inefficiency. And
From you, that's you know what you're talking about. So that's serious criticism.
Yeah. Well,
what could they do better?
Well, for one thing, they could get organized, and they are to a certain extent doing that, but it takes them too long to do things. Also, for instance, right here at the Veterans Hospital right here,
yes,
there are about 24 or 25 people who go there every day, spend their day there, and go home. They don't do any work because they disagree with something. I don't know what happened, but they had some squabble among themselves, and these people just show up and don't do anything all day long and go home.
These are employees?
Are employees, yeah.
Okay.
So I think they're inefficiently run.
Yeah, well, there is something wrong there, that's
for
sure.
And they've improved, I have to say that, over the time. They've improved in the last year or so.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
In what ways? What have you seen that's different?
Well, seem to have more physicians.
Okay.
And in spite of the fact that they still have trouble getting physicians or getting adequate physicians, they get a lot of guys who just couldn't make it on their own in practice, you know.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So they get a lot of ineffective personnel, but with what they get, they seem to be doing better than they used to.
Now, sir, you have several problems that are linked to Agent Orange, including, if I'm right, you have been diagnosed with diabetes. Is that right?
Pardon?
You have diabetes.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Now, I claim that stuff gave me diabetes.
Yes. Now, is that type 2 diabetes?
Yes.
Do you get everything that you need from and through the VA hospital to manage that?
Well, I'm not sure. I think I get the latest stuff that the government has approved and buys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm not so sure that I get the results of the latest research.
Why do you think that?
I don't know. I just think they respond too slowly.
I see. I see. In terms of acting on it at the at the patient level,
that's what I think. I think it just takes too long to get from the planning level, the purchasing level, down to the dispensing level,
down to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, have you been able to take advantage of any training, you, your wife, that will help you negotiate now? As I guess. You explained to me you're losing your sight or have lost your sight.
Well, my wife is a big help to me because she has to take me everywhere I go.
Yes, sir.
And she has to read everything that I get in print, you know, because
yes,
I can't read it. I can't see it. And so I have to depend on my wife an awful lot.
Does the VA there offer any kind of assistance to you, particularly because you're now losing your sight?
No, they don't have any. As a matter of fact, it seems to me they're way behind the curve on that. For example, the pharmacy sends out, God, they dispense enough medication to, you know, I take enough pills every day, really, to fill up a good-sized coffee cup. And it seems to me that quantity, not quality, is the answer as far as the VA is concerned.
Do you have a sense how many different physicians do you see with all the things that you have going on? Or is there one person who manages everything?
Well, there's one that's supposed to manage everything, you know.
And
that one informs you out to the different things as they see the need, you know.
The different specialists.
Yeah.
And do you think that system works fairly well? I mean, that's sort of an HMO kind of approach.
Well, I think it would work all right if you could be sure that the physician you're seeing was really a good physician. But they have a lot of people that just couldn't make it on their own, you know.
Do you feel like the physicians that you're seeing are up to speed? I mean, can they handle what you've got going on?
I'm not sure they're up to speed, no. I think a lot of them are people that couldn't make it anywhere else.
Well, that's pretty worrying.
Well, it is, yes.
I don't like to hear that.
Well, I don't like to hear it. I don't even like having to say it, but
I'm sure
but it's a fact, you
yes,
know.
Sir. Yes, sir. Well, Colonel, if we can, let me turn to the issue of the use of Agent Orange and those kinds of defoliants and so on.
Okay.
I mean, in a way, and I don't know whether you would accept this, perhaps it's not correct, but it's a kind of, I think, chemical warfare.
Yeah.
And what turns out to be the case up front, which is all the plants die and therefore you can see the enemy and you die in the field of fire and so on, has these long-term effects that we don't anticipate. And I'm sure, you know, there are Vietnamese, of course, who are suffering as well.
Sure.
Do you think that you ought to have known what was being done? I mean, I'm sure you didn't really know what they were using.
I didn't know what they were using. And
possibly they didn't know either.
Well, I think they didn't, you know.
Yeah. I mean, how does it sit with you now?
Well, like I said, I often wondered, then, what the hell are we doing here? And secondly, I wondered, do we know what we're doing if we can come up with a reason for being here?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure we knew what we were doing.
Do you feel like this kind of conflict, like we were in Vietnam, it seems like we may be in Iraq, is sort of the future pattern of
I'm afraid it might be.
Of wars?
I think big wars, such as World War I, World War II, might be a thing of the past.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think it's going to be the Iraq-type thing from now on, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that they'll ever be able to get together with big groups of countries to fight one another, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be this spot stuff around the world, different places, from time to time. And I hate to see that. I'd rather have a big war and have it fought and over with than to have something going on here for 2 or 3 years or 10 years and then move over there for another 10 years, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we're stuck with wars, you know, isolated in different parts of the world from now on, you know.
Do you suspect that the U.S. military can adjust adequately to fight these kinds of wars instead of the big frontal assault sort of wars?
Well, it seems to me we haven't adjusted very well in the one we're involved in right now.
Yes, sir.
So I don't have too much hopes in the future, you know.
Yeah, well, coming from you, I mean, you're a long career guy. I mean, with a lot of experience, that's you know, really kind of discouraging. What do you think they could do differently? Not get involved in the first place, or
that's the first thing.
Okay.
Try to avoid it at all means, you know, by
yes,
all
sir.
Means. But if you have to do it,
mm-hmm.
don't drag it out. Hit hard, hit fast, and get out. I mean, we have the capability,
mm-hmm.
we have the know-how,
mm-hmm.
but we don't use it. You know, we're piddling around there with this little old country of Iraq when we should have wound them up long ago, you know?
And is that how you felt about Vietnam? Maybe we should have gone into northern Vietnam and, like, attacked Hanoi or something?
I think we should have attacked them when we had the chance.
Yeah, earlier on in the country.
Yeah, but, you know, I had some friends who were killed up on the reservoir, you know, somewhere during the during the Vietnam War, and I often wondered, you know, we were afraid of the Chinese coming down through there.
In Korea?
Yeah, you know, in Korea.
Yes, sir.
I think we had the capability, we should have let them come down and nuke the hell out of them.
Just use the atomic weapons against them.
Yeah, sure. I think when you got your back against a wall, somebody's fighting you, you ought to fight them with everything you have.
Why do you think we haven't done that?
I have no idea. I cannot imagine why we haven't done it.
But your feeling is that weapon should actually be taken out of the closet, out of the mothballs? And
use it, you know. I mean, if you're in a corner and somebody is beating the daylights out of you,
mm-hmm.
and there's an axe or a hatchet or anything down there, and you don't use it, then you need to get the beating you're getting.
Do you think the United States is going to be a superpower 15 years from now, like we are now?
I'm not sure we're a superpower right now.
Really?
No.
Okay. Because
I think we're way below our level right at the moment,
uh-huh.
and we're not getting anywhere fast. I think our thinking has kind of fallen apart. I mean, we don't seem to be able to concentrate our power where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads me to another question. Should the United States, do you think, have some kind of service requirement? You know, right now we're obviously relying on an all-volunteer force.
Well, yeah, and that all-volunteer force is the lowest economic level in the country.
We're
fighting this, mm-hmm. whatever we call this war we're mixed mm-hmm. up in right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're fighting it with the poorest people in the country. You don't see any millionaire sons out there.
And does that feel to you just wrong? Is it wrong?
Seems to me it's wrong. When your country is involved in something, it ought to be involved by all the people.
In other words, equally spread the.
That's right. I mean, just because Joe happens to come from a poor family,
mm-hmm.
and Bill comes from a rich one, doesn't mean that Bill ought to be able to sit home and do whatever he wants to do while Joe's out there getting shot.
Yeah. What about women in the military? How do you feel about the changes that have taken place?
Well, I have never really approved of women in the military and combat units.
Yes, sir.
I mean, there are plenty of jobs in the military that can be and should be and can better be done by women
uh-huh.
than by men.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think combat is one of them.
So you would just as soon see women not in combat roles, but still part of the support team.
Well, I think they should be part of the support team. And anywhere you have male and female,
mm-hmm.
there's more likely to go on than combat.
Yes, sir.
You know what I mean?
I think I do, yes, sir.
Yeah, well, anyway, and when that happens,
mm-hmm.
then the combat effort is diminished. Because people just aren't paying attention to the things they should be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. They're paying more attention to one another.
They're distracted from
mm-hmm.
the mission.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Colonel, in winding up, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like to contribute to the oral history record that we're creating today? Any of your recollections that you would like to contribute, that I might not have asked you the right question, something that came to mind?
Well, I can't think of anything offhand.
Okay.
Seems to me you've got a pretty good coverage of it.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and end the interview here. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Now,
all right.
Go ahead, sir. Please describe your children's careers, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Well, we have four children. The oldest boy is about 50 years old. He's retired from the Army. And His wife, by the way, is also retired from the Army. She's about the same age. Number two boy was a Navy pilot, and he now flies for Delta Airlines. And the number three boy, he's one of these Beltway bandits in Washington. I don't know what he does. He does something for the government, but I don't know what it is.
But he served in the military as well?
Pardon?
He served in the military?
Oh, yeah. He retired from the military.
Which branch was he in?
He was in the Army. And my daughter is the only one still in the military. She's a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force.
Where is she stationed right
now? She's stationed at Tampa at Central Command Headquarters.
Yes. And what is she doing? What area is she in? What specialty?
She is a protocol officer. I don't know what she does, actually.
Protocol officer. And she's a lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel, yes.
Well, I congratulate you and your wife on a very fine family, all of whom have served the country. It's extraordinary.
Yeah,
it's extraordinary. Congratulations.
Very proud of them.
I'm sure you must be, sir.